Okay, Paul Johnson, let me quote from him regarding this change, all right? Because, you know, we tend to think the Roman Empire collapsed. Historians say the Roman Empire came to an end in 476 AD. It wasn't just an immediate collapse like that. It had been in decline for a long time and various things had happened. But that's as good a date as any to pick out for the fall of the empire. And this is what Paul Johnson writes. Though the administrative center of the empire had been transferred to Byzantium, you know, Byzantium is way over to the east. Remember, the Roman Empire in its later centuries had the two halves, the Eastern Empire, the Western Empire. The Eastern Empire was run from what is today called Istanbul in Turkey, but at the time it was Constantinople, or then Byzantium. It's had the all three names. Constantinople, named after Constantine, the emperor we were talking about. Though the administrative center of the empire had been transferred to Byzantium, the state religion was still conducted personalist, centralized, anti-regional. It didn't allow, for example, people in England to pray in English. And later on, wouldn't allow people to read the scriptures in English. It was against regional variations, every Rome. Already, indeed, its chain of command and its contact with outlying regions such as Britain were maintained in a more regular fashion than the political and military functions of the empire. Christianity still had a working international infrastructure. This religion, by its very nature, was centralized, universalist, authoritarian, and anti-regional. You know, listen to that carefully, because the religion carried on the Roman system. It was authoritarian. You had to basically comply with what Rome said. It was run by a disciplined priestly caste, commanded by bishops based on the imperial urban centers. Under the ultimate authority of the Bishop of Rome itself, the spiritual voice of the Western Empire, its doctrines were absolutist, preaching unthinking submission to divine authority, which meant the authority of the church. The emperor and his high priest, the Bishop of Rome, in this world, and a unitary God who appointed the emperor in the next. Basically, the Pope was the vicar of Christ, so he was, as Jesus Christ, on Christ's throne, okay, ruling the church. And the emperor then took care of the temporal affairs, ruling the people. The emperor told everybody they must go to the church, they must be a part of the church. The church told everybody to obey the emperor. And so therefore, between the two of them, they had everybody under control. And that's the way it has been in European history. And it didn't change until the 1500s with the Protestant Reformation. And we'll come to that in another lecture later on. But let's go back to these horns again in Daniel chapter 7, because what we see in history is quite interesting. We see various resurrections of the Roman Empire. Remember, we've already seen in Revelation chapter 17 how this system goes right through to the second coming of Jesus Christ. We see that in Daniel chapter 7. It goes right through to the second coming of Jesus Christ. We saw it in Daniel chapter 2. It goes right through to the second coming of Jesus Christ. And yet we are living right now in a period of time in the year 2004 where this Roman system does not dominate the world. You know, we have basic freedoms here in the United States. We're not as free as we sometimes like to think we are, but we certainly are a free country compared to most of the world. And, this is an aberration in history. It is something that is unique to this period of time. This has not been the case for our ancestors, even those ancestors that lived in Europe, because Europe did not have those same freedoms. So, you know, we need to understand this Roman system has been a dominant presence in world history for the last 2,000 years. In fact, the power of Rome was not broken until the Protestant Reformation in the 1500s. So let's go right back to the beginning. You know, there's a great deal of chaos in the second and third and even fourth centuries when it came to Christianity in the Roman Empire. And what emerges in the 300s, when we see the Council of Nicaea, what emerges is this universal church, this Catholic church based in Rome, which is very much against the teachings which we understand from the New Testament. The church changed radically Now, there were a number of different reasons for that, and we don't have records of every single thing. But I can summarize it up in this way, and it's rather interesting that, you know, what you had is in 66 AD, the Jews rebelled against Rome. And in 70 AD, the Romans crushed the Jewish rebellion. And later on, the Jews rebelled again in 132 AD. And by 135 AD, the Romans had totally wiped out the Jewish presence in what we call the Holy Land. And the Jews then dispersed, the diaspora. And it wasn't until 1948, just after World War II, that the Jews got a homeland back in the Middle East. During the rest of the time, they were just dispersed. But because the Jews had been such a troublesome province, there was this intense hatred of the Jews throughout the Roman Empire. And what was Christianity at that time but a Jewish sect? The Christians kept the Sabbath, kept the holy days, just the same as the Jews did. And so there was this incredible persecution which kept on coming against the people who were Christians as well as the people who were Jews. And because of that persecution, the Christians went underground. And when they emerged, you had something very different, because a lot of people grew up wanting to compromise with the world, wanting to compromise with the Roman system, the way the Romans did things. And so you had this syncretism take place between Roman paganism and Christianity, and what came out of that was Roman Catholicism. And even after the Protestant Reformation, the Protestants basically simply just continued the same doctrines as the Catholic Church. So this has been Christianity for the past 2,000 years. But we need to go back as well to the Roman Empire to see something else that happened, because as you see from this chart that you're just being given, you see the first beast at the top, the lion, then the second, the third, the fourth. We've already covered those. Now we come to the resurrections of the Roman Empire, because you see these first three horns that were plucked up by the roots. Now this is what happened historically to the Roman Empire. You had the city of Rome was sacked by the Vandals in 455 AD. And then in 476, Odoacer took over the rulership of Italy. He was what historians call the first barbarian king of Italy, who became king in 476, supposedly recognizing the supremacy of the Eastern Emperor, because the Eastern Empire of Rome continued from 476 until 1453, another 1,000 years. But the Western Empire, so that is Rome and everything west, Italy and everything west, the Western Empire came to an end in 476. And like I said, it had been a gradual decline. But the Romans considered the people outside of the Roman Empire barbarians. And the barbarians had sacked Rome in 455. And then in 476, Odoacer took over as the first barbarian king of Italy. And then in 493, the Ostrogoths, under King Theodoric, who was appointed king of Italy by the Eastern Emperor, they defeated and killed Odoacer, and they then took over. Now, each of these did not last very long, and they did not put down any roots. The Romans left roots. You go to Rome, and you see all these buildings, the ruins of the old Roman Empire. You can still see the Colosseum. In fact, they've just reopened it as a theater. It's still there, even 2,000 years later. You can go to the Circus Maximus, where they had the chariot races. Remember the movie Ben-Hur? And although be careful when you go there, when my wife and I went there, we got robbed, so be careful. We were only in Rome 2 days and got robbed twice, so that's a warning to everybody. But anyway, you know, the Roman Empire has a lot of these great, magnificent buildings that were there in the past are still there today. The ruins of them are there. You can see how it was a great civilization. But these three tribes that took over in rapid succession simply just sacked the place. They just went in, they took what they could, they stayed for a while, and they left soon afterwards. But then something interesting happened. Then you had the Eastern Emperor, Justinian, who came from the east and tried to resurrect the Western Empire. The Eastern Empire is the brown part there. The Western Empire that Justinian managed to recapture is the purple part. And there was a difference between Justinian and those three that I mentioned, the Vandals, Odoacer, and the Ostrogoths, because now there was church involvement as well. You see, with those first three, they were pagans. And those were the little horns that were plucked up by the roots. They were plucked out by the roots. They never put down any roots, basically. You know, they just never had any major presence. They were just there taking what they could as the Roman Empire fell. But now suddenly there was this other major power that had arisen in Rome. And it is the church. The church, which even Pope Leo the First, I think it was, stood up to the pagan tribes and appealed to them not to, you know, destroy the city of Rome. This is, you know, what happened at that time. You had these three pagan, barbaric tribes that just took over in rapid succession. But now there came up this horn, this little horn, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots, and there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking pompous words, the religious element, the papacy. And now there were to be seven more resurrections of the Roman Empire. The seven heads that are prophesied in Revelation chapter 17, the seven heads, the seven mountains on which the woman sits. Seven major resurrections of the Roman Empire throughout history. So let's have a look at those. Justinian's empire did not last very long. When he died, the empire basically went with him. But the dream of uniting Europe has continued throughout the centuries. In fact, it is still there. The dream of uniting Europe as one political entity, one military entity, and also one religious entity. So let's have a look at the next attempt to try to put Europe back together again as one empire. Here it is. Charlemagne's empire. Charlemagne, Charles the Great, who was crowned by the Pope on Christmas Day in the year 800. And look at how big Charlemagne's empire was. Now, again, you can look at this and you can yawn and think, of what relevance is this today? And yet, there was an article just last month or 2 months ago in a British history magazine on how Charlemagne's dream is influencing those that are trying to unite Europe today. That basically Charlemagne laid the foundation for a dream of a united Europe, which has been passed down 1,200 years later and is inspiring the people of Europe today. Charlemagne wanted a united Catholic Europe, resurrecting the Roman Empire again. And, that was his empire. So we've seen Justinian, who tried to unite the empire again, with the church playing a role as well. Although, you know, they butted heads. They weren't, always in agreement. But with Charlemagne, we see the same thing here again. Then we move to the next resurrection of the Roman Empire, which is the Holy Roman Empire, which was established in the middle of the 900s, 961, 962. It is that purple area there, and again, that is another attempt at resurrecting the Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire wasn't holy, it wasn't Roman, and it wasn't an empire. But having said that, you know, what's in a name? You can see Rome was not in the empire itself, and it certainly wasn't religious, it wasn't holy, it wasn't godly at all. And it wasn't really an empire because the emperor didn't have absolute control over all of those areas. But, you know, on paper it was there and it existed for almost 1,000 years. It finally was abolished by Napoleon in 1806. So it lasted almost 1,000 years. In fact, if you start it from Charlemagne, you know, you could say for 1,000 years this system went on. But the Holy Roman Empire formally began in 962 AD. And that's what we're looking at there in purple. So, you know, we've seen three resurrections now with the church involvement. Justinian first, Charlemagne second, and now the Holy Roman Empire. Now let's go to the next one. Charles V's empire in the 1500s. And this was an incredible empire. In fact, Charles V had the biggest empire in the world after the Roman Empire and before the British Empire, which turned out to be the biggest. But Charles V was a Catholic monarch. He was the Holy Roman Emperor. He was crowned in 1519. He was born in 1500. He happened to be the emperor at the time that Martin Luther began the Protestant Reformation. And it fell to Charles V to try to sort out that mess. Now, Charles V lived in Vienna. You see Vienna there on the right, the yellow part there. Charles V controlled everything that's colored yellow there. He was also the king of Spain. Now, remember, at this time, Spain ruled South America and even parts of what is now the United States, California, Texas, and so on. In 1494, the Pope had divided the world between Spain and Portugal. And Spain was the dominant power in the 1500s. Charles V was a Habsburg, a family which ruled Central Europe right up until 1918. They ruled Austria, Hungary, and lots of other countries in Central Europe as well. This is the Habsburg family that has been central in European history for over 1,000 years, because they go right back to the Dukes of Burgundy over 1,000 years ago. And everything colored yellow there was Charles V's empire. But Charles V also controlled, as I mentioned, a great deal of the New World. The Philippines, for example, later on became a part of this empire. Charles V's son was Philip II of Spain. And Philip II of Spain tried to retake England in 1588. England had broken away from the Catholic Church. And the church, the Pope gave him his blessing to invade England, because everybody had to come back into the Catholic fold. So the vision that they had, Charles V and his son Philip II, was of a universal Catholic empire. The same as Charlemagne, the same as Justinian. See this? The same with the Holy Roman Empire. You see how we've got a theme here that runs through European history. The stream of a universal Catholic empire, because the Pope is the vicar of Christ, and the belief is that the church is the kingdom of God. So now we come to the next resurrection of the empire, of the Roman Empire, which is the empire of Napoleon. Napoleon was also crowned by the Pope. Napoleon was from Corsica and ruled France. And you know, when you look at this map, Napoleon basically conquered the whole of Europe. He didn't rule everything directly, but you know, those territories with dots and lines were either occupied by Napoleon's forces or else they were allied to Napoleon. But look how big Napoleon's empire was. In fact, it was only the English that stood up to Napoleon. If you've seen the movie Master and Commander, you'll know what was going on at that time. But Napoleon was really a major threat, and this was an attempt again at universal domination, at world power. Now, the French Revolution began as an anti-religious revolution, but you know, the church was involved in this as well. Napoleon was crowned by the Pope, and so you have this church-state coming together again, and this attempt at universal domination. Then we come to the next resurrection of the Roman Empire, which was more recent. This is the First World War, 1914. And here again was an attempt at universal domination, this time by the Germans. In fact, when you look at history, the resurrections of the Roman Empire, you know, I've had a strong German involvement. You know, even going back, Charles V, for example, Austria is the Osterreich, is its name in German, meaning the Eastern Reich. And this is the Second Reich. The First Reich was the Holy Roman Empire. Reich means German. The First Reich means empire in German, I'm sorry. And, you know, here is the Second Reich of the Kaisers. And, you know, it's interesting, too, that increasingly historians look at the First World War and the Second World War as one continuous conflict between the Anglo-Saxon powers, the British and Americans, and the Germanic powers, Germany and Austria. In fact, I've even seen the term used, the 30 Years' War, to describe World War I and World War II, as if they're just one continual conflict. Because the way World War I ended, World War II was inevitable. And it came about just 20 years later, 21 years later, is when World War II came about. and you had, again, let's have a look at the maps here. This is Europe in 1925, after World War I, before World War II. You had a lot of new countries that came into existence at the end of World War I, which complicated things a lot in Europe. But it shows how the map is changing again. And then we come to 1942, and this is the Third Reich. And just as the Holy Roman Empire had lasted almost 1,000 years, you know, Hitler proclaimed that his Reich would last 1,000 years, the Third Reich, but it didn't last 1,000 years. But look at how much territory was conquered. You see the dotted line, an incredible military force that conquered so much of Europe in such a brief period of time. So this was the Third Reich. And, you know, the Second and the Third Reichs, which were a part of the same conflict, we could look at as the another resurrection of the Roman Empire. Now, it was difficult for a long time to understand the church connection here. But if you read the book Hitler's Pope, you find an interesting connection there. Hitler's Pope is by John Cornwell, came out 3 or 4 years ago. He's a Catholic historian. And he was concerned that Pius XII, who was Pope during World War II, Pius XII became Pope in 1939 and died in 1958, so he was Pope during World War II. John Cornwell was extremely concerned that this Pope was accused of all kinds of terrible things, collaborating with the Nazis, for example, in World War II, and doing nothing to help the victims of the Holocaust. So Cornwell got the permission of the Vatican to look at the archives in the Vatican Library to exonerate Pius XII. But he found, as he spent his 2 years in the Vatican Library, that the reverse was the case, that all the evidence showed that Pius XII was guilty of some of the things that had been said of him. Out of all the people in the world, he was probably the only one who could have done anything to stop the Holocaust. Because, you know, Rome, Italy was a part of the Third Reich. Mussolini was the dictator of Italy, and it was allied to Germany, and later on there was even a German presence directly in Rome. And, you know, the Pope could get on the radio, he would give his message each year, he could have, in one of his messages, condemned what was going on, but he didn't. And even when Jews were rounded up within earshot of the Vatican, he did absolutely nothing, and nothing was said. And Hitler's Pope, though, shows not only his involvement in what happened in the Holocaust, but it also shows how, when he was a cardinal before he became Pope, he contributed greatly to the rise of Hitler by a deal that was done between the church and the state. And even going back to World War I, that his involvement as Secretary of State in the Balkans contributed to the events that led to World War I. So, you know, here was the church again involved in the politics, which contributed to, you know, these two wars which took place. Look at Revelation chapter 17 for a moment here. Revelation 17 says there are, in verse 9 it says, the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. A mountain is a great empire. You know, and these, when you look at these resurrections in history, you know, these were the great powers of their day, of their age. You know, they dominate European history. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. One is. You know, what does that mean? Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. Obviously, these seven, you know, are not at the same time. You know, they are successive empires with maybe gaps in between. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. Well, I think, you know, we felt that the explanation for this is that, you know, when the church was being raised up by God at this time in the 1920s, five had already fallen, but the one that is the one that was, you know, coming together here in the Third Reich. Before that, the Second Reich, it was actually, you know, there at exactly the time that Mr. Armstrong came to understand these things, and they were passed down to us. And then it says, and one has yet to come, the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. So let us have a look at the next one and speculate on that for a moment. Here we see, this is World War II again, just showing how the Axis powers conquered the whole of Europe. You see everything in the middle there. The Italians, the Germans, the Austrians, Hungarians even, were a part of the Axis during World War II. But now we go to, at least we're trying to go to, modern Europe here. Here is the latest attempt to bring about a resurrection of the Roman Empire. And the dream is to restore Charlemagne's empire. And of course, it's a lot bigger. You look at it even now, it's a lot bigger than it was. And this is the one that has not yet come. And it says in verse 12, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and strength and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. So we know this is going to happen before the second coming of Jesus Christ. And again, it's a continuation of this Roman system. Remember I said we live in an aberration in history because we have only known domination by the United States, and before that it was by Great Britain for a couple of hundred years. But even during the time of Anglo-Saxon domination, and I use that term to describe both British and American domination, even during the period of time of Anglo-Saxon domination, you had Napoleon's attempt at world domination in the early 1800s. And then in the 1900s, twice, you had an attempt by the nations of Central Europe at world domination. But both were defeated by one or both of the Anglo-Saxon powers. But now we're going to see this other resurrection of the Roman Empire, which is still to take place, the seventh one, which still has to come. But it's still a continuation of that Roman system, which has been a dominant theme throughout history. The Roman Church and the Roman system dominated Europe until the Protestant Reformation, and it was only after Napoleon, really, that the British were the supreme power, the preeminent power. So it's only really in the last 200 years that we haven't seen this domination by the Roman system. And World War I and World War II were still a threat to our freedoms. But here is the attempt to put together another Roman Empire. It was actually, the European Union was started by the Treaty of Rome in 1957, and the desire is amongst the nations of Europe to unite so that they will never again have a war like World War I and World War II. That is the dream of the European nations. And this is very different to the previous attempts to resurrect the Roman Empire, because previously it was done by conquest. Whether it was Hitler or the Kaiser or Napoleon or Charles V or whoever, they were trying to conquer the different nations. But in this case, these nations are coming together voluntarily, which means it will take longer because it's all done by agreement. It will take longer. But on the other hand, it won't have the violence, at least in theory, it won't have the wars that have taken place in the past or the despotism that has taken place in the past. In order to be a member of the European Union, you have to be a democracy. That's the way it operates right now. Now, the European Union as it is cannot be this final resurrection of the Roman Empire. We do need to understand that, because right now there are 15 nations, so 15 kings in the European Union. Everything colored light blue there, unless I've got Aaron's problem, and I'm colorblind as well. I think it's a light blue there, okay? You can see that. So that's the 15 nations of the European Union. Most of those nations to the right, are they a brownie color? I haven't got my glasses on here. See, I am having the same problem, Aaron. Most of those nations to the right are joining the European Union on May the 1st. 10 more nations, which will make it 25 countries. And already the European Union is the biggest trading power in the world. But on May the 1st, it will become the biggest single economy in the world, replacing the United States. And already we've seen a significant change in the past 3 or 4 years. All those countries with a diagonal line through them that are colored light blue, there are 12 of them if you want to count them. Those 12 all use one currency, the euro. See, gradually the Europeans have been trying to create this United States of Europe, which is now called the European Union. And gradually they've been giving up more and more of their sovereignty, more and more of their independence. And 12 of them agreed a few years ago to have just one common currency. Now, this may not seem like a big deal here, But imagine if the United States, Mexico, Colombia, Venezuela, Argentina, Cuba even, all agreed to have one currency. Imagine how that would change things here. And imagine, too, if America agreed that control of that currency should pass, say, to Venezuela. You know, imagine, would we do it? No, we wouldn't. So it's been a major step, you see, a major step for these nations to give up control of their own currencies to the European Central Bank. It's been a major step forward. And the euro, as you know, if you've been watching your news or reading your newspaper in the past year, has overtaken the dollar considerably as the country, as the currency of preference, let's put it that way. This does not mean the dollar is doomed or anything like that. I mean, currencies go up and down in value. But whether they go up and down reflects two things, supply and demand. The more people demand a currency, the more the value of that currency will rise, which of course also ties in with confidence. So the reason why the dollar has gone down by roughly 30% in the past couple of years is because the rest of the world does not have confidence in the United States like it used to. And the reason why the euro has gone up in value considerably, $1.26 is now a euro, whereas a couple of years ago it was like 85 cents, 85 American cents was a euro. So, you know, the euro has really gone up in value considerably. The reason for that is a greater confidence in the nations of Europe and in the euro as a more stable currency. It also reflects to a certain extent anti-Americanism because, I mean, Arabs, for example, I've read this recently, that many Arab nations have been moving their bank accounts to Europe because, you know, they feel that America is anti-Islam and, you know, they're just are registering their protests, so to speak. Something else of significance here, which is interesting, is that natural gas now is priced in euros. And I think a major problem for the U.S. will be if oil is priced in euros. Because if we have to pay in euros for oil, we could have a major problem in this country economically. You know, so far, oil is fixed in dollars. But, of course, the oil countries are losing money because the dollar keeps on falling in value. And most of the things they buy come from Europe, so they have to pay for those things in dollars, and they're having to pay out more dollars because the euro is worth a lot more. So the simple thing is to switch to the price of oil in euros. And three countries have already suggested that. And one of them is Russia, which is now, I think, the world's biggest supplier of oil. So, you know, there are interesting developments. But the point is, gradually these nations are coming together. Now, it says here that, 10 horns, which you saw, are 10 kings or 10 leaders who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. Now, you know, let's just speculate for a moment how that might happen. You know, the nations of Europe that have come together slowly, and it's always by agreement, and it takes a long time for each step to be made. There's a difference. There's a difference between Europe and America. You know, America's more like a caravan. Americans move around a great deal. And we don't really put up anything of substance. When building, and one of the first things I realized when I came to America in 1990 was that here you have the reverse of what they have in England. In England, the older a house is, the more it costs. Here, the older it is, the less it costs. Why is that? Well, in England, those old houses that were built of stone in the 1500s, I mean, a friend of mine had just inherited an Elizabethan home built in the late 1500s, and it's worth a fortune. And it's almost 500 years old. Now, most Americans, if they heard that a house was 500 years old, they'd say, yuck, you know, I want something that's, you know, just new. See, there's a different mentality. Europe's more like a fortress, and everything is built to last. It's built, you know, solidly. There's less space. There's more people crammed into a space. So the European Union is being put together very slowly and very carefully. And the foundation was laid first, and then, you know, the next floor is laid, and then the next one, and it takes a long time. Now, With the euro, Europe is united economically. The last step is political union. Political union. Because already there's plans for a military force, and they're putting together their own military force, which is being sent to Afghanistan, by the way, in August, the new Euro Corps. So, you know, that the military side is already taking place. Not very big, but it's taking place. But the next step is political union. And in December, just 2 months ago, when the European leaders met, they were discussing a proposed constitution for Europe. And it did not succeed because all 25 governments could not agree on it. And now there is talk of a two-tier Europe, that some countries in the European Union will go ahead with a full political union. And other countries will simply be a part of the economic union. It is possible, and this is just speculation, but it is possible that the number of countries that want a full political union may be 10. I mean, this could come out of this. It is also possible that this whole thing could collapse and be replaced by something else. But I think the desire for European unity is a desire that many people have, and the majority of people have. And the two countries which are the driving force here are France and Germany. See, France and Germany had three wars in one lifetime. There was World War I and World War II. But in 1870 and 1871, there was the Franco-Prussian War, a war between France and Germany. And the French have been determined that, you know, they will stay close to Germany and we will never have such a conflict again. And, you know, the Germans also are the dominant power in Europe, the biggest single economy, the biggest single population. If you forget about the Russians, who, you know, are too far away and too backward to really count in any of this. But, you know, Germany very much is a dominant power there. So the French and the Germans are two countries that are very close. And, you know, something they are doing, which has never been done in history, to my knowledge, is the cabinets of both countries now, you know, meet in joint session. I think it's once every 6 months. So, you know, there is this commitment to a full European Union. Now, the French think that they can control it, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's more likely that, you know, the French will not control it. But, you know, anyway, this is the dream, to put together a United States of Europe. And, you know, somehow or other, this prophecy is going to be fulfilled, and 10 kings are going to come together. I have an article that fell out of a book I bought in 1988, Paul Kennedy's The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. And I will be using that later on in one of the lectures. But Paul Kennedy looks at the last 500 years and looks at certain common themes in the rise and fall of the dominant power of the last 500 years, starting, incidentally, with Charles V in the 1500s. But he also looks at France, and he looks at England, and he looks at America. And he shows, and this was written in 1988, he shows that America, even in 1988, was in decline relative to other nations. Now, it takes a while for things to change. You know, in 1918, at the end of World War I, America really was the strongest power. But America decided to reject, or the Congress decided to reject Woodrow Wilson's dreams for American involvement in the rest of the world. America withdrew from the world. And so Britain remained the dominant power until World War II. Okay? So you see, when power is changing, it takes a while for people to realize the change. So it wasn't until the end of World War II that America was clearly the dominant nation in the world. And in 1988, Paul Kennedy wrote about how the European community, as it was called then, it's now the European Union, was already the dominant trading power. In 1988. And he wrote then that history shows that the dominant trading power ultimately always becomes the dominant military and political power. And it was interesting that this just fell out of my book, this article that he had written, which I'd stuffed in the book when I bought the book in 1988. And, you know, I'm thinking of using the article and some of its contents in an article for World News and Prophecy. But he wrote that in 1988. And the European Union now is an even stronger economic union. And it's interesting to see some of the developments that happened recently. President Bush, for example, had to remove the tariffs that he imposed on steel because the Europeans threatened to impose tariffs on American products. And America was the one that had to change. You see, Europe is the stronger trading power at this time. Europe has the stronger currency. The U.S. still has the stronger military. So we're in this transition period between from American dominance to European dominance. But Bible prophecy shows that at some point, you know, these 10 kings are going to come together and form the beast power, which is a continuation of the Babylonian, Persian, Greek, Roman system that has gone on for the past 2,600 years. Any quick questions relevant to this lecture? Yeah. Yeah, there is that too. See, there's a lot of duality in prophecy. And Rome is built on seven hills. And you've got this false church which is based there. And, you know, you've got the seven hills and, Rome, the Roman Empire was built on that. But you've also got these resurrections of the Roman Empire throughout history. And you see the relationship between the church and the state. You know, and Rome has been very much involved in that. So there's a duality there, yeah.
When you were reading, you said that they will rule for 1 hour. Is there a reason why they put a certain time in there? Would that mean like 60 minutes or like from God's eye? Or is there a timing for a reason they put that in there?
You have to think about how this vision was being revealed to John. You know, to John it seemed like it was an hour, okay? So, you know, whether so it's therefore figurative. Whether it's meant to be literal in this sense, that 1,000 years is to God as a day. So is an hour, therefore, 1/24th of 1,000 years? You do the math, how long is that? I don't know whether it's meant to be that specific or not. But in John's vision, it was a very brief period of time. And when this European Union, or whenever the 10 nations, whoever they are, come together to form the beast power, it's going to be hard to keep them all together. And, you know, you also realize there's going to be a crisis in the Middle East at the same time. It's just not going to last very long. But how long it does last is a question. Yeah.
It's going to be like economic and then political and then religious?
Yes, it's already economic. And it's becoming political. And it's not a religious system at all. I mean, religion plays very little role in Europe at this time. But this does not mean that you have to have a major return to religion. I mean, the papacy was heavily involved in the events surrounding World War I and World War II. And the papacy is already involved in the European Union, too. As to, you know, how great that involvement is going to be, that's a question mark. But, you know, it's going to be a factor.
Well, even our representatives and even our presidents have to go to Rome.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, the drive for European unity is paralleled by a drive even for Christian unity, as in the mainstream Christian religion. You know, I mean, in England, for example, I mean, England broke away from Rome in the 1500s. And Queen Elizabeth is the head of the Church of England, but she goes to Rome and meets with the Pope. And there is this drive to, you know, reunite the Anglican churches, which includes the American Episcopalian Church, with the Catholic Church. And also the Pope is reaching out to the nations of Eastern Europe, the Orthodox Church as well. So, you know, who knows what this is going to lead to? And maybe there will be a return to religion by the people. You don't know.